Hey listeners, this is Abir Sichter. On this episode of Local Global Leaders, titled Amor Vincit Omnia, which is Latin for Love Conquers All, I spoke with Emma Curtis, a city council member here for the Lexington-Fayette Urban City Government. I really appreciate how she talked about the importance of her identity and how that empowers her, especially to overcome barriers. I also loved hearing about her background as an independent filmmaker and how she brings a creative mindset to her advocacy and her government work. And she also shared some best practices to collaborate with her community and how that can create change. Hope you enjoy listening. Greetings, listeners. I'm here in the studio today with Councilwoman of Lexington, Emma Curtis. Councilwoman Curtis, thank you so much for joining us here at WUKY.
Oh my gosh, thank you so much for having me. It's a real joy. You know, a longtime listener, first time caller, I suppose.
Thank you. But you know, two of my mutual friends, I think mutual friends of ours, Cameron French.
Yeah.
And then Belle Townsend.
Oh my gosh, I love them. Yeah.
Yep. I was in New Leaders Council Kentucky with them in 2023, and so they told me about you, like, that was 2 years ago, and heard a lot about your work. And then when I heard you're on city council, I'm like, oh, I got to get her on the podcast.
Oh, my gosh. Well, that's very flattering, and to get any sort of praise from Belle or Cam is its own honor. So I'm highly flattered, to say the least.
Awesome. But, yeah, they're great friends. But just so excited to have you on and just, yeah, wanted to get to know you. So starting off, to tell our listeners, you know, we want to know about your personal life and kind of your leadership journey. What do you want listeners to know about you initially off the bat?
Sure. So my name is Emma Curtis. I hope folks will remember that. I am the councilwoman for Lexington's 4th District. District 4 is a little slice of heaven. There's about 28,000 folks there, and it sits outside of New Circle Road, all the way to the Jessamine County line, then in between Nicholasville Road and Tate's Creek Road with a little smidgen cut off around Veterans Park. So it is on the south side of Lexington, and it's where I've spent my entire adult life since graduating college. I love it there very much. I have a background as a filmmaker. I have primarily done nonfiction, documentary work, commission work. The most recent film that I directed was called There Is No Answer. It's a film about George Sakelly, who is a professor here at UK for roughly 50 years, and a local artist who has this remarkable backstory and has made a remarkable contribution to our city and our Commonwealth. And that aired on KET last year. And the thing that I really want people to remember is that I am a Kentuckian. When I was growing up, I couldn't put the words transgender Kentuckian together. Those two core concepts of myself that I knew to be equally infallible were constantly at odds with each other. And the narratives that we've been told about what Kentucky looks like or how Kentucky has to exist, behave, and whatnot were really damaging to me. I couldn't see anybody like me in my community, you know, here in central Kentucky, here in the greater Lexington area, being themselves, being trans, being vocal about that, and also succeeding at just doing their job. So I hope that if folks are trying to get to know me, they recognize me as a Kentuckian who's also a trans person.
Yeah, you kind of you're very very proud and outspoken, right, about that dual identity.
Yeah, of course. Yeah. And you know, I think that right now at this moment in time, so much of the conversation on, you know, if we're going to talk about this in binary terms of left versus right, which is not how I like to think of things, but is how so much of our discussion is framed. On the right, you know, trans folks are being vilified and scapegoated and made into a genuine target for elimination from public life, really. And then there's discussion on the left about whether our existence is a political liability. And at the end of the day, we're just people. We just exist. We're here. We're your neighbors. We're your friends. We're your family. And whether we're serving you coffee at Starbucks or we're serving you as your council member in City Hall, we are part of this community. And so I really, really try to make a point that those two things are not contradictory. They are, for me, inseparable parts of my identity.
Mm. It's good that you share that. I know it's of course not the same thing, but I felt something similar growing up as like a Bengali American and Eastern Kentuckian. And now I just say I'm an Eastern Kentuckian, Bengali American, but people in Kentucky or Eastern Kentucky didn't have an issue with that. It was mostly like people from outside the state or friends who were like, oh, like, are you really from Kentucky? Or like, are you really there?
Right.
And even admittedly in the family, they're like, no, we're Bengalis. We're not Kentuckians. I'm like, no, I grew up here since I was three. But I can, you know, I try to be proud of both identities now. So,
no, as you should. It's, you know, something that that really bothers me and that you touched on is that so much of this narrative is coming from the outside in. And I think that Kentucky has a reputation that's not warranted as a place that doesn't accept the genuine melting pot that we have here, that people have these identities that are seemingly on paper to somebody who isn't familiar with them contradictory, but they're not. We're just here, and we can see each other and celebrate those differences because we're all better off for it.
Yeah, appreciate you sharing that. You mentioned, of course, that you're an independent filmmaker and have a background in that. How has, like, filmmaking influenced your personal and, like, your leadership journey?
Sure, yeah. I mean, the first thing about filmmaking and what drew me about it, drew me to it in the first place, was that it's a collaborative art form. So much of art is people sitting around, you know, writing and then sending it off and getting feedback, or they're sitting with a paintbrush and they're painting on their own. But with film, you're working with a bunch of different people who are all focused on their tiny portion of the big picture. And so I wanted to be a film director because I recognized that I wanted to be a jack of all trades and a master of none. My mom raised me to be a very curious person. And so I couldn't pick an area of specialty. I wanted to know about everything. And so that, I think, has translated into advocacy, into holding elected office, in that you recognize when you're directing a film that you don't know everything about everything, and you lean heavily on the people that you trust to know those things. And so as an advocate, as an activist, and as a councilwoman, I surround myself with people that I know are the experts, and I can push back and we can have these conversations. But your job as a filmmaker, just as it's your job as an elected official, is to empower the people that you work with to do their best work. It's really a servant leader position either way.
That's awesome. And yeah, it's cool to have like that art inspired, that collaborative team effort. When I interviewed, for my first episode, interviewed your colleague, Councilman Dan Wu, said kind of a similar thing about how, like, he's like, I don't try to worry about being the smartest people in the room. I try to get them in the room and then hear from them. And he's also kind of got a bit more of a media creative arts and a restauranteering background.
Yeah.
So I feel like there's something there in the art space. Maybe we need more kind of artistic and creative leaders in public office, right?
No, I definitely think that, you know, I learned a whole heck of a lot more about being a leader from getting a film degree and studying film and working in the arts than I think I would have learned from getting a political science degree. And that's not to, you know, yuck anybody's yum. Mm-hmm. I think that, you know, political science, it's a great area of studies. I enjoyed the classes that I took there, and those were also very valuable for me as I've come into a public policy oriented career. But it's really about, in my mind, that collaborative effort that the arts dares you to have, you know, to think outside of what's been done before, to recognize that while you might exist within a context of how things have been done, that that's not necessarily the way they have to be done. Mm-hmm. So often when we talk about the arts, it's in public policy, it's in the context of like education cuts to the arts in favor of in those who want to cut the arts in their minds, more, you know, less frivolous endeavors. But the arts are really what makes us human. It's our avenue for expression and understanding the world around us. And I think that that's something that is sorely missing from a lot of our elected officials, is a willingness to engage with others and come to a better understanding of the world around us as a result.
Yeah, I think that makes sense. As someone who, I was an economics major, but poli sci minor, then went to law school, but learned a lot of exactly that traditional rules-based thing. Here's how things work. But like, if we have people from outside that space, kind of like you said, they'll think outside the box, have newer solutions, things that we're not traditionally taught in. Also, yeah, and it makes me think too, growing up, I also had a dream in fourth grade of being a director. My parents were like, I had movie ideas for that I'd pitch with every day. It was mostly after my friends and I saw the Lord of the Rings trilogy.
Ah, yes.
We actually wrote, I think we wrote like an 80-page script that was like basically Lord of the Rings, borrowed some elements from Harry Potter, Star Wars. If it ever came out, we would have been sued.
Well, I don't know, but see, that's, again, that's Joseph Campbell. That's, you know, the hero's journey. That's all of these, you know, Jungian archetypes. There's a reason that all of those films are so similar. It's because they hit on something that is universal, which is our desire to better understand our place in the world and to experience more than we are told that we should be able to experience. You know, all of those are about people who are living seemingly ordinary lives, who then go on a grand adventure that broadens their worldview and then shapes the person that they become. Like that's like the core tenet of, I think, our existence as human beings.
Uh-huh. So if I'm hearing correctly, if I find that 80-page script, a notebook paper or somewhere at my parents' house, you'll be the director, right? Well, that movie, if we make it.
Well, we can have negotiations. You can have your people talk to my people. You know, I'll definitely give it a read.
But yeah, that's like that hero's journey. That's not just, you know, like we see as a fictional tale. But yeah, like I said, that is a common element across all these stories. And there is a reason for that. Like, we can all relate to it. That I really appreciate you sharing that. And with that, you know, I want to ask now, like, I think you may have kind of answered this already, but what motivates you to be a leader?
Well, what motivates me to be a leader, first and foremost, are my neighbors. I am really, really blessed to live in a community of people who really care. And they don't just care about one specific thing. Everybody has a very unique thing that they care about. And then I'm in a position where I get to show up and listen to them and try to translate that into public policy. And if we're in a position where, you know, local government is sort of superseded by the state government and then the federal government, what can I do to help further that cause? And there are some people that are very interested in issues that council doesn't really have much power over. Mm-hmm. But I'm still their elected representative, and I view it as my job to advocate for those things. So it's walking and chewing gum at the same time, right? You know, I love talking to people about potholes. I love talking about sidewalks and pedestrian safe infrastructure, investing in multimodal intersection design to help improve traffic flow and pedestrian safety at the same time. Like, I can get into the policy weeds all day, but there are also a lot of people in my community who are really concerned about what's happening at the federal level. And anything that happens at the federal level touches us here in Lexington in one way or another, whether that is the revocation of federal funding for our local community nonprofits, or that is, you know, some of the international students at UK having their visas revoked without warning. That comes from the federal government. And when you get elected to state or local office, you are acting as kind of the safeguard there. You are showing up for the people who elected you. And if those people want you to push back on that, it's your job to push back on that. I rigidly believe that it is my job to advocate for my constituents, no matter what it is. And if I have the power to do some good as a result of that, you know, that's what it's all about.
That's really great to hear. I think a lot of us here of politicians, particularly local politicians, I've had this experience myself, when you ask them for help or ask them about something, they just say, well, it's not really what we do, or it's not, you know, not like my job. And they just kind of, yeah, wave it off. But you try to, like, you're like, no, like, bring it to me. Like, you want to find a solution no matter what it is, right?
Yeah, of course. And, you know, one of the great things about being a local elected official is that if it's something that, you know, is a state level thing, I know our state representatives and senators. It's nothing for me to, you know, go give my state rep Chad Aull a call and say, hey, I've got this constituent who's concerned about this. You know, let me put them in touch with you. Mm-hmm. You can still act as that connector. You can still do that. And if, you know, like at the federal level, you know, my mother raised me, if you can't say anything nice about somebody, don't say anything at all. But I will say that I do try to communicate with Andy Barr's office when there are issues that arise that are related to the constituent services that are intended to be offered by members of the House of Representatives.
That's an important work to do, to like reach across the aisle, because that's who we have in place, right? That's who people have to work with. So,
yeah, I mean, governments should be full of people who are there to collaborate for the benefit of the people that they serve, not to antagonize each other for the benefit of their own careers. I am not interested in fighting anybody, but that doesn't mean I'm not going to stand up for what I believe in, for what is going to benefit my community on the south side of Lexington. And when we get into these larger discussions involving the General Assembly and the federal government, for the city of Lexington at large, because even though I just represent the 4th District, you know, the Lexington Fayette Urban County Council is making decisions for the entire city and county. Mm-hmm. So I want to make sure that, I'm considering the needs of other parts of our city as when I make these decisions, when I decide how I'm going to vote on something, when I'm considering a proposal that comes across my desk, because I don't think that you need to put one group down in order to lift another up. You know, there's enough here in Lexington for all of us, and we should all get to see the rewards of that.
Awesome. And yeah, that's great work you do here in elected office. And with that, what inspired you to run for office?
So my history with running for office is a little complicated in that it's not something that I ever wanted to do. I grew up around politics. My mom worked for governor Wallace Wilkinson during and after his term as Kentucky's governor. And my uncle worked for the Legislative Research Commission, for Steve Beshear, for Bob Babbage, for the House and Senate Democratic caucuses, had a whole lot of involvement in state government. And the thing that I saw, because of my proximity to a lot of the people who worked in this field, was people that I knew to be good, kind, caring people having their worst tendencies brought out by this process. Mm. And so I didn't want to be a part of that. The reason that I pursued the arts and more activism-related stuff was because I felt like that's where change happens, was pressure from the outside. And the thing that shifted my understanding of that was somebody that I knew from activism circles, you know, was elected as my state rep. And his name was Lamine Swan. And I was very blessed to have him as a mentor figure. He really shifted my understanding about the relationship between activism and elected office, mm-hmm. and that those two things don't have to be inherently contradictory. He had encouraged me to run for something, and I was considering it. But he unfortunately passed away part of the way through his first term in the state house. And that was a shock for a lot of people. He was a remarkable man, and the work that he did still echoes in the work that's being done today, both in Frankfurt and here in Lexington. And on a selfish level, I miss my friend. But when he passed away, it triggered a nominating contest for a special election to fill out the remainder of his term. Some of the folks that were really close to him asked me if I would put my name in. And when you're talking to, you know, his friends and family and, you know, his mom and the people that talked to him every day about his service, and they're saying Lamine would want you to do this, I don't know how you say no to that. And so I did an unorthodox thing, which was I ran a campaign for a special election nominating contest. But Lamine taught me that the things that I had viewed as a liability, like my transness, or like the fact that I came from an activism background or had worked in the arts, I had viewed those things as liabilities. And, you know, Lamine was a history maker in that he was the first person in the history of the Kentucky General Assembly to use a wheelchair, the first elected representative. And, you know, we were talking about a black man and a young person who didn't come from wealth, who had a disability using a wheelchair. And he turned those things into his superpowers. He recognized the inherent worth of his being, that those things were not liabilities. They were, in fact, the very things that made him qualified to hold public office. And so I started thinking about it that way. And I didn't get that nomination. And that was very tough. I felt like I had let Lamine down. I felt like I had let his family down. And I felt like I had let a lot of people down. The trans community, a lot of folks who I had talked to who were starting to engage with politics for the first time because somebody that they knew from their spaces was getting involved. And I had to learn some hard lessons about leadership there, of striking the balance between doing what feels like the right thing to do and working to get the best end result. And so by then, I knew that I could run for office. And one of the things that Lamine told me the last time that I spoke to him, it was at the Capitol. He was just getting around to decorating his office after his first session. And he said, you know, if you need to run and if you don't win, keep showing up and keep doing the work and then run again. And if you don't win, keep showing up, keep running, and eventually you'll win. He ran for state house for the first time when he was 26, and that's how old I was at the time. And he didn't win. And so, you know, he kept showing up, he kept doing the work, and then he ran for city council, and then he didn't win. And he kept showing up and doing the work, and he ran for state house again, and he won. You know, and so there was a lot that I learned from that example. And so I knew that I wanted to consider running for office again at some point. And so it really was just looking around and seeing what room I felt my voice could do the most good in. And this council seat, I noticed that my council member wasn't voting in a way that was reflective of my community, and wasn't showing up for the people that elected her to represent them. And it didn't seem like anybody else was going to mount a challenge to her in any serious way. So I decided, well, you know what? Hey, I'm going to throw my hat in the ring. And, you know, if I don't win, I'll keep showing up. I'll keep doing the work. But that's really what pushed me towards running for elected office, was wanting to honor Lamine's memory. And, you know, I told Pam, his mom, when he passed, that any place that he would have been, I would show up and I would try to make sure that the work got done, because that felt like the best way I could honor him. And I meant that, and that's still something that I think about every day that I go into work. I've got a picture of us together sitting right on my desk. And, you know, I hope that the work that I'm doing now would make him proud.
Yeah, well, I definitely think it would. As such a historian, your story is one of such like resilience and perseverance. And yeah, kind of what you said about keep doing the work, keep running, reminds me of like of Abraham Lincoln. And he actually lost most of the elections in his life. He only won like three of them, and he eventually became president. But it's important to have that perseverance.
Yeah.
Elected office.
Absolutely. And, you know, I think that there's nothing more powerful than proximity and perseverance. It's you show up and you keep showing up and you don't be a jerk and you show up. And eventually people take notice of that. And eventually, you know, things will work out the way that they're supposed to work out.
And when you ran for city council, of course, running against an incumbent, like, was that something tough? Would people give you warnings about it or discourage? Or like, you know, what was that specifically like?
Oh, yeah. I was absolutely told not to do it. the common refrain that I had gotten from folks was, your time will come, wait your turn. And I don't think there is a single statement, concept, idea, or piece of advice more damaging to anybody who's pursuing whatever it might be, not just elected office, then wait your turn. When somebody tells you to wait your turn, what they're telling you is that they don't think you deserve a turn. I was warned against running against an incumbent because she was a registered Democrat, and I'm also a registered Democrat. And this team sports element of politics, even though council's a nonpartisan office, you know, again, I don't think I could hide my partisan affiliation if I tried. But I was told, no, you do not challenge a sitting Democrat. It didn't matter that she was voting in a way that was the most conservative of anyone on the council. It didn't matter that her policies were not aligned. It was you do not do this. And that's what I hate about the team sports element of politics, right? You know, it's the idea of we're going to go based on what letter is next to somebody's name where they're registered to vote rather than the actions that they're taking in elected office. I was terrified to do it because, you know, the last time that I ran for something, I lost. And when you lose, it's scary to go again. I dealt with a lot of blowback after that. There was a lot of miscommunication and hurt feelings within our local party over that nominating contest and the election that followed. And so it took a lot of encouragement from people that I trusted to throw my hat in the ring. And, you know, I did it in a way that I could be proud of, which wasn't necessarily how I had handled everything with my special election run. You know, I had to learn a hard lesson about who you trust, and that just because somebody belongs to the same marginalized group as you doesn't necessarily mean that they have your best interests at heart. And you had, in my case, I had to learn how to navigate I had to learn how to distinguish between people who are operating in good faith versus people who weren't. So running for council became for me also about the desire to run a campaign that I was proud of and to do it unapologetically as myself. And I think we did that, and I think that it showed.
That's so amazing. You talked about sort of, yeah, that activism space being discouraged in politics and elected office. It sounds like in your role, like, do you like combine those two directly in the legislating, or do you separate them in some ways at times?
I think they are not, it's not possible for me to fully separate them. That is my background, and I don't treat activist or activism like a four-letter word. I think a lot of politicians do. But if you're an activist, it's just that you're somebody who cares and you show up and you're unapologetic about caring and showing up. my role as an elected official requires me to operate in a different way a lot of the time. There is, again, you know, I do a lot of trans activism and trans advocacy work, but on council, you know, we already have trans protections, LGBTQ protections for the city of Lexington. You know, I'm really blessed to live in a city that values everyone for who they are. And we have protections in place there. But at the state level, that's not the case. And so I do keep a little bit of a distinction up there for when I go and do work in Frankfurt. But at the same time, I do think it's worth noting that I was elected in a district that is generally pretty conservative. I won multiple precincts that Donald Trump also won on the same night, you know, and it took me a long time to grapple with that and try to understand, you know, who are the people that are voting for me, but also voting for Donald Trump, somebody who I think on almost every single issue is antithetical to my core beliefs, and somebody who has turned my community into a political target out of, you know, what he views as expediency, I think. I do bring that up, and I do think that that informs the activism and advocacy work that I do, because you have people who are overlapping with my district in the legislature who are sponsoring and pushing anti-trans laws. And the reality is that the same people elected us. If they are constituents who we were elected to serve don't have any problem being represented by a trans woman, maybe, just maybe, it's not an important issue to them. Every piece of data and polling shows that it's not an important issue. And so, and not an important issue in the minds of voters. So there's no political advantage to it. But they view it as such. And so going and being able to just show up as an elected official in those settings is kind of engaging in activism. And it shouldn't be. I should be able to just go to the state capitol as a council member from Lexington and advocate for my city. And I love doing that. There's so much that I do in that regard that doesn't get a whole lot of news coverage because it's not as flashy. But I love that work, candidly, a lot more than I love the trans advocacy work that I have to do in Frankfurt, because nobody wants to go and have to debate their right to exist. And doing that time and time again is a very draining task. But I can't, like we were talking earlier about, you know, being trans and being a Kentuckian, those things are inseparable for me. And so I can't only advocate for one group. Mm-hmm. You know, I was elected by the people of the 4th District to serve the people of the 4th District. But by the circumstances of my election, I'm also the first openly trans lawmaker in the Commonwealth of Kentucky, second openly trans elected official, and the only trans person holding public office in the Commonwealth of Kentucky right now at a time where our community is more under attack than we've ever been. So I'm very conscious of the fact that I'm also representing trans Kentuckians from across the Commonwealth, even if they don't live in Fayette County. And I take both of those roles very seriously. They're messy, they're intertwined, but I don't think that they're inherently contradictory. It's, again, walking and chewing gum at the same time.
It's a big balance there. You've talked about, you know, so many of the successes you've had in your leadership journey in public office, but also some of the conflicts and struggles. What would you say is the biggest struggle you've had in your leadership journey?
I think the biggest obstacle that I've faced in my leadership journey has been just people trying to keep me out of the room where it happens, you know, proverbially, regardless of what political entity you're engaging with, there's a real cultural problem around older folks not wanting to allow younger voices. And, you know, that's the reason that, you know, when Trump was sworn in, he was the oldest president ever elected. And that was coming after Biden, who was the oldest president ever elected. And it was a rematch between those two people. Like, that's a gerontocracy where you have a population that isn't represented adequately by leadership. You have elected officials who are staying in office into their 90s, you know, and that's true all the way down to county party executive committees as well. People don't want to let the younger people have power. There's a real reticence to do that, and it's hurting us. You see that in the Republican Party. You see that in the Democratic Party. And I think that the only way that we get past that is just to keep showing up and outworking people because, you know, I can tell you that I can't think of a more miserable existence than to spend, you know, I'm 28 right now, than to spend 40 plus years in elected office. I don't want to be getting into my 70s and 80s and clinging to power with every last ounce of strength that I have. You know, the role of a good leader is to recognize when it's time to step up and also to see the potential in other people to step up and take your place. These seats that we hold are bigger than any one person. And, you know, right now I'm blessed to occupy the 4th District Council seat. And I'm also blessed to follow several people in that seat who demonstrated that value, who showed up and then passed the torch. And, you know, whether they were moving to a different elected office or whether they were moving out of elected office, you know, that has been a trend. And so, yeah, the biggest obstacle is just people using what institutional power they have to try to keep young folks, to try to keep trans folks, to try to keep working class folks, to try to keep renters, strangely enough, you know, out of the conversation. And there's this very condescending tone that people have taken. And you have to put up with a lot of nastiness and keep showing up. So that has genuinely been my biggest challenge, is the dismissal from people who are supposed to be fighting the same fight on the same team. You know, dismissing me because of my age, because of my gender, because of anything that they deem to be different from them. People are scared of change. People are scared of what they don't know. So I hope that just by showing up and continuing those conversations, they're getting to know me and they're getting to know people who have different experiences, and that that change will come as a result.
Yeah, it's a lot of negative mindsets and biases that you have. You know, people experience it with it. They don't, may not even know you, but just because of the community part of it. As you mentioned, being a young person, being a trans person, they just hear that or see that. And even that alone, they just want to keep you out of the room without even knowing you.
Yeah. I mean, you know, one of the things that kept happening when I was running is that I would see people engaging in these conversations, be that on social media or, you know, somebody talking to me about a conversation they overheard about, oh, well, what are her qualifications to be in office? Oh, well, she's trans. Didn't you know that? Well, nobody was talking about the fact that I've lived in this community my entire life. Nobody was talking about the fact that my platform, my policy platform, didn't deal with me being trans. I didn't run because I'm trans. I ran because my community needed a new direction, needed to be represented in their halls of government where they weren't being represented. And so, yeah, there are a lot of factors at play. And I could not have imagined when I decided to run for council that we would be in this position where we talk about, quote unquote, the transgender issue. Like, what is that? We're talking about a group of people's existence as if it's a question of whether or not you like pineapple on pizza. But these are real people with real lives, and we just want to exist. So, yeah, you know, people would ask me, what are you going to do for trans rights on council? And I would talk about, you know, well, you don't think trans people get stuck in traffic on Nicholasville Road? You don't think that trans people struggle to afford housing? You know, these issues are also universal. They don't just impact somebody based on their identity. And I hope that we can move in a direction where we're doing things that benefit everyone rather than singling out a group to pick on.
A lot of toxic mindsets to overcome. And I was curious, you know, what are examples of toxic leadership you've experienced, and what have you learned from that?
Yeah. So I worked for a while in advocacy with another trans person that I, you know, really thought understood. And I struggle to talk about it because I think that there are so many good examples of leaders in our community, in our country, in our world, that my natural tendency is to focus on the positive examples. But, you know, you're right in that I do think there's a lot to learn from toxic leadership. And really what I think toxic leadership is about, I've experienced people who think that because they are in power or they have a certain title that everybody works for them. And, you know, leadership isn't about having the people serve you. It's about serving the people. It's about empowering those around you to be their best selves and do their best work. And, you know, you're kind of like a cheerleader, right? And I dealt with somebody who worked on a couple of people, actually, who worked on my first campaign when I was new to all of this, who I learned later were not so much interested in these policy changes, who weren't so much interested in making a significant impact for South Lexington or for trans Kentuckians, but were interested in their own personal ambitions. And I really struggled to wrap my head around that. And they tried to exercise control over me rather than to empower me to be my best self and do my best work. And that sticks with me. That is something that I have. Gosh, I think about that way too much, honestly. But I don't ever want to be that person, you know? I don't ever want to be thinking that because I'm the only trans elected official in Kentucky that I understand every trans person's experience and I speak for every single trans person, you know? Like, we just like any other community have a whole world of different experiences. It's not just about me. And I think that you can't ever let that ambition or that urge to lead with anything other than love and compassion take over. And that's what I view as toxic, is when leadership becomes about fighting other people for the sake of fighting, or, you know, displaying authority for the sake of displaying authority, rather than actually helping people.
Yeah, I think the society, people were naturally inclined to want to help each other and support each other, but then somehow in, I wouldn't say it's government, but somehow in the, I think the politics process, it just, that corruption happens, kind of like we were saying earlier with like facing an incumbent and them telling you not to run. It's something in that political process, it's very artificial that's created it. But you talked earlier, you know, about your leadership style, like being a creative director and collaborating. So I'm sort of imagining you kind of like a Martin Scorsese on a film set.
Oh,
and, you
my
know,
gosh.
All the experts coming in.
I don't know about that. That's very flattering. But I don't think that I'm Martin Scorsese by any means, you know. He's the master. Yeah.
We'll go with Chris Nolan or Ryan Coogler. Or so.
I share a birthday with Chris Nolan, fun fact.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Oh.
July 30th.
Oh, wow. Can you tell us more about your leadership style? Like you mentioned that philosophy,
yeah.
But like what? Yeah, like what would you say is like your style? Or
yeah, so the example I'll give is so every council member has a legislative aide that is their staff member, and then we have a team of council core staff that works for the entire council. And I hate even saying works for, because I view it as works with. They are the ones that have this wealth of institutional knowledge. And candidly, you know, they were there before I got there and they'll be there after I'm gone. It doesn't matter, you know, if I serve one term, or if I serve, you know, the six terms that I'm allowed to serve. These are people who are dedicating their lives and careers to making the city of Lexington go, making the wheels turn. And so we have this breadth of institutional knowledge. But I'll talk about my relationship with my legislative aide a little bit, which is so her name's Sarah Ritter. She's amazing. And the thing that I always tell people is that they're really getting a 2-for-1 deal here because she's remarkably smart, remarkably competent, and has a lot of experience within city government as well. And so every meeting that I go to that she can possibly be at with her schedule, we go together. And I'm not shy about that fact. I'm not shy about that whole 2-for-1 deal concept, because if we can collaborate and get more done for the people of the 4th District, that's great. I don't need to have all the credit, you know? I care a whole heck of a lot less about credit than I care about tangible good, tangible action. And part of that has been having really candid conversations with Sarah about what our respective strengths and weaknesses are, and trying to empower both Sarah and myself to do the work in our office that is best suited to our skills. And we have a very complementary skill set. And so for me, my leadership style is about inviting people in. It's about asking different people's opinions on things that might not always be what I went into something with. I try to have an attitude of open-mindedness and an attitude of gratitude. The great thing about working in City Hall, as opposed to, you know, the work that I've done in Frankfurt in the past, is that people are so excited when you want to talk to them about their work. You know, I love going around Government Center and just asking people what they do, because again, I'm a district council member. We're elected to 2-year terms. I went to as many council meetings as I could before I, you know, before the election and before I was sworn into office. So I knew like the procedures for formal meetings, but I had no real concept of what went on behind the scenes. And it's been so gratifying to know that there are people running our city on a day-to-day basis who, you know, I spent the first few months trying to meet with everybody that I could. And the question that I always ended with was, what does your ideal relationship with a district council office look like? Because there are some people who their work doesn't really change regardless of what policies council passes or where funding gets allocated so much. But there are some people whose jobs are highly dependent on that. And I want to be having an open door policy with them. And again, I think it's our job as council members to empower them to do the best work on behalf of the people of Lexington. So it's having that open door policy and having it be clear that, you know, I am not going to fix everything on my own, but I'm sure as heck going to try to fix as much as I can and do as much good as I can. The best way to do that is to invite other people in and to collaborate them with them and empower them to be the best versions of themselves. And I think that, you know, I've got a real, you know, partner in governing with Sarah, and we've built a really good operation for the people of South Lexington. I'm very proud of that.
That's awesome. That's, yeah, really great of you to highlight. Yeah, like your legislative aide, someone behind the scenes. I don't think people like that get recognition enough. I think that answers the questions. I think your directorial style then sounds like maybe like the Russo brothers, you and Sarah, you and Sarah collaborating, right?
Yeah, and so that's the thing. You know, a lot of folks don't name names, right? Mm-hmm. It's you know, oh, I have a wonderful staff or whatever. But I want to like highlight as many people as possible and make sure that they get credit for the work that they're doing. And it's not because like these people don't do this work because they want credit or they want a pat on the back, because let's be honest, municipal government is not a glamorous job. The pay is not great. The hours are long and arduous, and you are dealing with a whole world of bureaucracy that you didn't create, and finding how to best maneuver within that system. And so I just think that is the most admirable thing ever. And, you know, it's the same attitude that I try to bring to conversations with constituents, right? You know, I think that there's no greater blessing than a life lived in service to others. And I genuinely believe that. So I'm not there to have Sarah work for me. I'm there to empower her to do her best work.
And what you said about, like, often failure to recognize people. It reminds me of, I don't know if you know the comedian Bill Burr, but the stand-up bit he has where he talks about Steve Jobs, and he's like, oh yeah, Steve Jobs goes up on the stage. It's all the kids like, look at me, I'm Steve Jobs, I made this. But it's like, then Bill Burr's like, what about like the dozens of engineers who actually built the iPhone?
Yeah.
Why don't you recognize them?
No, and I think that that's, you know, as we see somebody like Elon Musk ascending to power, you know, Elon Musk is not an inventor. Elon Musk is somebody who was born into generational wealth that took companies that had already created things and just basically failed upwards and took credit for any successes when he wasn't really responsible for any of them to begin with. And I can't think of like anybody who's less humble. You know, I think that part of, you know, leadership is humility. And I think that we could all stand to exhibit a little more of that, especially at this current moment where we have leaders at the highest level of our government who seem physically incapable of being gracious or showing humility or not making everything about themselves.
Yeah. And there's so many, yeah, like things you have to do well and the flaws you have to realize in yourself to be a successful leader. I have what I call my three M's of leadership, motivator, manager, and mentor. It's like being an effective motivator, being a competent manager, and then being a supportive mentor.
Mm-hmm.
How do you see those three roles? Do you see them as like three separate things or three things that all naturally tie together? Like, do you divide them up when in your role as a leader? Or how do you view them?
I think that I don't think I could divide them up if I tried. Honestly, I think my style of leadership is to just show up, do the work, and lead with love. You know, I feel like I get a lot more out of just talking to somebody as a human being rather than embracing some sort of hierarchical power structure. You know, that for me is what it's about, right? It's about getting to know people and recognizing that if you're a leader, you know, again, I might be mentoring somebody. You know, I'm really grateful. I just joined the advisory board for Emerge Kentucky, which is an organization that trains Democratic women to run for office across the Commonwealth. And they're a great organization doing great work. And I've been really blessed that I get to mentor some remarkable women in that program. And I'm also really blessed that I've gotten to learn a lot from them, too. It's a two-way street, always, you know? So for me, part of being in a leadership role is selfishly, I get the opportunity to learn about other people and to take the lessons that they've learned and apply them to my own life and how I navigate these spaces as well. But I think, yeah, I mean, being an effective manager, it's knowing that everybody works differently and that, you know, not dismissing somebody because they work differently than you, but embracing that difference and finding ways for y'all to collaborate. That's my big thing. It's collaborate, collaborate, collaborate. We're nothing without the people we surround ourselves with. And, you know, something that I've taken a little bit of flack of from people in my own party is I have a standing policy of, you know, I'll get a coffee with anyone. I don't care how much I disagree with somebody. I think that we can disagree without being disagreeable. And oftentimes when you meet people where they're at, you learn that the thing that they're actually, that you disagree on, you actually underneath that have similar motivations and you just don't agree on how to best achieve the thing that you're trying to achieve. Now, sometimes it just goes poorly and you both walk out mad. But if you don't show up to that, you're not giving yourself the opportunity to, you know, change somebody's heart or change their mind. I think that's what, you know, those three things, right? You're being a motivator, you're being a manager, and you're being a mentor. I just try to be myself and hope that I'm setting a good example.
That's awesome. I appreciate you answering all those questions about, you know, like your personal journey and your leadership journey. Now I wanted to ask some questions about the local global context and then throw in some fun questions for this part. But yeah, what advice do you have for leaders, for people who hope to become leaders? And I think in particular, young leaders like yourself who hope to run for office.
Yeah. The biggest piece of advice, I think, you know, I hate to sound like I'm a broken record, but when somebody tells you to wait your turn, don't listen to them just because they're somebody who's older than you or they're somebody who has held positions of power. You know, you'll know if it's the right time for you. You're going to know a whole heck of a lot better than somebody who has been in power for, you know, 30, 40 years. I think that young people are so often discouraged from taking up space. There's this idea that, you know, you cannot be an effective leader as a young person. And that's just bogus. It's just not true. When I was knocking doors on my campaign, I had people ask me constantly if I was old enough to run for city council. And I'm like, well, yeah, they wouldn't let me run if I was not legally old enough. But, you know, the age requirement is 18 and I was 28. And that was something that really bugged me because at the time, you know, Joe Biden was still president and, you know, he was in his 80s and he had been in government since he was 27, you know. Mm-hmm. He was first elected at the age of 27 and nobody was telling him that he was too young, you know. Nobody was saying, oh, well, you need to wait your turn and maybe by the time you're, you know, 35 or 40, you can take that step. I think that right now for especially young folks, especially women, especially people of color, especially immigrants, especially LGBTQ folks, especially working class folks, especially people who grew up in poverty, especially people who don't look like what we deem an elected official to look like. These are the folks that reflect the communities that we live in, and we should be investing in them rather than investing in the same middle-aged to senior cisgender, straight, middle class or wealthy white people that we have been investing in as, you know, when I say us in this context, I mean the Democratic Party, candidly, we've been investing in for decades. And it's gotten us here, which is not a great place for us. And I do think that's applicable outside the Democratic Party. That's just the example I use. But, you know, don't be afraid, because the people who are in power were once not in power. And in all likelihood, at one point, they did not wait their turn. So, yeah, don't be afraid to take up space and know your worth, that if you have ideas and you want to see things change, show up, do that work. And don't let anybody tell you that you can't because of who you are, or how old you are, where you're from, or because you're too tall or too short, or your hands are too big or too small, or whatever other bogus reason they give you.
And when you ran, did you kind of look at or even kind of like collaborate with other people who are running? You know, I think in this generation or through the 21st century, we, like you mentioned, we've seen a lot more young people run for office, mm-hmm. at every level, more LGBTQ Americans, more marginalized Americans. Did you, like, I guess, sort of tie, do you feel like you tied in directly to that movement, or do you feel like your run was, like, separate from that, or how do you look at that?
When I ran, I was so, so blessed to work with two specific organizations, Run for Something and LGBTQ Victory Fund. And through those organizations, I was able to not just partner up and learn from other young folks and LGBTQ folks who were running for office, both across Kentucky and across the entire United States. I was able to learn from the very people whose work I sought to emulate, because, you know, you always look towards people who have done something similar to what you're trying to do. And, you know, what was a really wonderful moment for me personally is, so I did with Run for Something, they have a candidate mentorship program where somebody who has worked with Run for Something before is in elected office, mentors a new candidate for office. And I was blessed enough that my mentor through Run for Something is Representative Zoe Zephyr, who is a state rep out in Montana, who's, you know, a young person, a trans person, who had a lot of similar experiences in dealing with, you know, being told to wait one's turn, being, you know, left out of the room. And because of that mentorship, I genuinely don't know that I would have been as successful as I was without that. I certainly would not have gotten to the end of my election with my mental health still relatively intact. But that's the great thing about an organization like Run for Something, is that the work that they do, it doesn't just apply when
you're running, right? It keeps going. And I was at a conference in December in Washington, D.C., and Zoe had been through the Run for Something mentorship program, too. And her mentor was Brianna Titone, who's a trans woman representative out in Colorado, who's running for state treasurer now. And we all got to like share space together, and we realized sort of that, like, you know, generational thing. It's almost like being in a sorority, right? You know, and having that sort of generational thing, it ties back into the idea of, you know, passing the torch. And it's not just about passing the torch. It's about recognizing that when you are lucky enough that other leaders who've been through what you've been through are reaching down to pull you up, that it's your obligation to then also reach your arm down and pull the next round of folks up. You know, we're all in this together, and I'm so, so blessed to be part of that community nationwide. And, you know, again, if you're a young person looking to run for office, I cannot recommend Run for Something enough. And whether that was with Zoe or with Michelle Thimios, who I worked with extensively there, or whether that's, you know, anybody in that organization, cannot recommend them enough. And if you're not somebody who is eligible for that, there are always people who are going to be willing to help. It's you just got to be unafraid to ask for that help.
That's awesome. Yeah, sounds like great organizations doing a lot of amazing work. Of course, you've been, you know, a notable LGBTQI+ leader here in Kentucky, done a lot of great work in that field, not just as city councilwoman, but even before that. With that, you know, this episode's coming out during Pride Month. So what do you plan to do to celebrate Lexington's local theme for Pride Month of Out and Loud?
Well, I mean, I think I plan to be just that. You know, I went to a lot of punk and metal shows when I was younger, so I've got some hearing damage. I can't help but be a little bit loud. And I'm certainly out. I make no secret of the fact that I'm trans or the fact that I'm queer. You know, I am very, very blessed to be in a city that, you know, I'm following in the footsteps of other queer people, even though I'm the first trans person elected here in Lexington. You know, I'm coming after Jim Gray, who is the first openly gay mayor in the South. You know, in the District 4 seat alone, our current county clerk, Susan Lamb, who's a queer woman, held that seat before I did. And they sort of paved this pathway. All of the activists who fought to enact our local fairness ordinance, you know, back in 1999, when I was 3 years old, they paved the way for me to be able to be out and loud. And so I'm so grateful to them. And so I want to celebrate them. And I also want to celebrate all of these young folks, these young LGBTQ people who are being told time and time again by their government that they don't belong, they're not valued. And in some cases, as with trans youth, they're being told they don't even exist. The best argument against that is to just exist as a trans person. I want these kids to see that their city values them. And so I plan to be out there. You know, we've got Lexington's Pride Festival back outdoors after a couple of years inside the Central Bank Center. And I think that at this moment in time, that makes a very real statement that the city of Lexington is not ashamed of our LGBTQ community. We welcome our LGBTQ kids. We welcome our LGBTQ adults, families, seniors, people of all different experiences. And we're better because all of those folks are here. A lot of the narrative about being queer or being trans is about the hardships that somebody who is queer or trans will face. But the truth is that I love being trans. I love being queer. It's these other people who are either ignorant or bigoted. You know, they either don't know that joy or they choose to ignore that joy to try to elevate themselves. They're the ones that have an issue. You know, I live my life as out and loud as I can be. And it's not about, as some people might say, you know, oh, shoving it in our faces, da 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 da. But I'm also not ashamed to, you know, like be seen in public holding hands with my partner. That is something that I love to do because I love my partner and I'm not gonna hide her from the world. I'm not gonna hide the fact that I'm trans. You know, I didn't run for office because I'm trans, but I didn't run from it either. I'm certainly not going to start now. So, yeah, I want to be and intend to be as active and, you know, as visible and supportive of that part of my community here in Lexington this month. Or not this month, but this coming Pride Month.
In addition to the local theme, how do you plan to celebrate the global theme of Pride Month this year, which is the fabric of freedom?
Yeah, I think that right now the freedom to be is under attack for LGBTQ folks worldwide and especially trans folks. I think that right now what we need nationwide is for people to acknowledge that you have a right to be. And that is a foundational freedom afforded to people who are in this country and who exist all over the world. You know, the freedom to be, the freedom to exist, that is not something that's endowed upon a person by their government. That's endowed upon them by their creator. Their worth is inherent to themselves, you know. All of us, our worth is inherent to ourselves. So how do I plan on celebrating that? I don't know that it's a celebration this year. But I do know that our community has had a whole heck of a lot of nastiness thrown at us. We've seen legislative attempts to literally legally define us out of existence. But we're still here. And we're still going to be here. And we are part of the fabric of this Commonwealth and this country. So I plan on trying my darndest to drive that point home that trans people have been in the Commonwealth of Kentucky since there has been a Commonwealth of Kentucky, and we will be here so long as there is a Commonwealth of Kentucky. And the same can be said of the United States, and the same can be said of any other country in the world. You know, a world without trans people has never existed, and it never will. There's a lot of fear right now, and we have to be constantly fighting back. But a quote that I found myself coming back to that I think is particularly pertinent in this context is from the writer Emma Goldman, which is that a revolution without dancing is a revolution not worth having. And so we're going to have fun and we're going to exist as ourselves and we're going to fight back in the process.
That's a great quote. I appreciate you sharing that. Maybe this would be the answer to this question. What advice do you have for leaders, you know, whether individuals, organizations, or movements who really want to put Kentucky and Lexington in particular on the global map and show the world what Kentucky has to offer?
Yeah, I would say that my advice on that front is to tell your story. You know, if you're from Kentucky, you are Kentucky. You know, this Commonwealth belongs to all of us, not just the people that divisive politicians have determined it belongs to. This is a place that has a long and storied history of people from all kinds of different backgrounds. You know, we have to reckon with the difficult parts of our history as well, but we don't talk nearly enough. I mean, my uncle was one of the photographers, you know, shooting pictures down in Frankfort when Martin Luther King and Jackie Robinson marched on the Capitol. You know, this is a place where we have people like Senator Georgia Davis Powers, who is the first black person and the first woman to serve in the Kentucky State Senate. And, you know, she didn't like the narrative that was being told about this place, about her community. And so she showed up and she changed that narrative. There is so much power in embracing your identity as a Kentuckian. So my advice is to be yourself and not hide the fact that you're a Kentuckian. We have so much to offer here. And it's been my whole life, at least, since there is a culture that's centered around embracing Kentucky as a place that looks to the future, not a place that lives in the past. But that's not the Kentucky that I know. And if you know a Kentucky that's unique to you, be loud about that. Take up space with that. And, you know, the adage that I always come back to, Kentucky's worth fighting for. And there are a lot of people, especially on the national level, who I think have written us off, mm-hmm. who think that, you know, oh, these people have elected Mitch McConnell for X number of years. You know, no, that's such a small-minded view. There's no such thing as a red state or a blue state. You know, there are just states where one party reliably gets 51% of the vote or more. And the amount of, you know, gerrymandering, the amount of manipulation that goes into creating that 51% isn't unique to Kentucky. It's, you know, across the country, and it's candidly both parties do it. And so we've got to stop thinking in terms of Kentucky as a ruby red state where people think backwards and will kick you to the curb for being different. Because, listen, I transitioned in Kentucky under the first Trump administration, and I was terrified to do that. I ultimately faced very little barriers to doing so. I thought people were going to be so mean, but they weren't, because that's just not who we are in Kentucky. We love our neighbors. We show up for each other. And even if somebody's different from us, we don't tend to kick them aside because of it. You know, we, again, we can disagree without being disagreeable. And our politics don't reflect that, so our people have to. So if you're looking to put Kentucky on the map, that's what I would encourage you to emphasize.
That's a lot of good stuff that to show the world what we have to offer. How do you also look at what's happening in the world and, you know, kind of bring that here to Kentucky and the work you do as on city council, also as a filmmaker, and the activism you do?
Sure. I think that we're experiencing a moment of historic division and also apathy, right? Like, people don't believe that government can be an avenue for good things to happen to them. What I try to do is show up and make tiny changes that make my constituents' lives tangibly better. I think that what we've done in Lexington and what we continue to do, and, you know, I'm so grateful to my colleagues for this, is that, you know, we come from all different backgrounds. We have a myriad of different partisan affiliations, but the second that we step into council chambers, we are Lexingtonians first and foremost, and we govern as such. And what that means is that we collaborate. There's not this hostility between, like, the mayor's office and the council in the same way that, you know, with the state and federal government, you see a hostility between the executive and the legislative branch. Our executive and legislative branches are members of the same team. We work together, and we put Lexingtonians first. We don't. I just love our city government. and so that's what I try to bring to it is, you know, a reminder that things don't have to be this way. Politics and government don't have to be so miserable. You can show up and do good things for people. And, you know, one of the women who was one of my predecessors in the District 4 council seat, her name is Isabel Yates. She passed away recently, and she was a remarkable woman and a remarkable Lexingtonian. One of the things that she said was that you ought to be proud of the place that you live, and you ought to live so that place is proud of you. I try to do that. That's what I bring every day that I show up to council to do my work, is I try to live so that this place is proud of me. I think that we all feel a pressure to save the world right now, but none of us can do that on our own. I think that tiny changes add up. And so right now, that's where my head is at, is encouraging people to live so that the place that they're from is proud of them, and make the tiny changes where they can. Because if we all do that, it's going to be a whole heck of a lot better in the future.
Yeah, for sure. What are some leadership lessons you've learned? Really excited to ask you this, since you, of course, you're a filmmaker. Leadership lessons you've learned from movies and TV shows, or even like pop culture.
So I was thinking about this question. I think the best example that I can give is I have learned a lot from the Wachowskis. So for those of you who don't know, the Wachowski sisters, Lily Wachowski and Lana Wachowski, are two trans women. They directed the Matrix films. They directed V for Vendetta. They didn't direct V for Vendetta. They wrote and produced V for Vendetta, Cloud Atlas, a whole bunch of just really great pieces of cinema. And those were films that I loved growing up, and that I still love, and that I'm still constantly rewatching. They made a series for Netflix called Sense8. I literally have a Sense8 tattoo right here next to my Commonwealth of Kentucky tattoo. They have brought, through their work, I think, significant shifts in understanding in the world. And when other people tried to take the wrong lessons, you know, one of the things, the idea of being red-pilled or whatever, a lot of this, like, toxic masculinity and sort of sexism that got caught up within the Matrix culturally, that, you know, Lily got out there and said, this is garbage, and what are you talking about? You know, like, wasn't afraid to talk about her art in that way. And she's been a wonderful advocate for the trans community. And the same with Lana. You know, she went and made another Matrix movie where the whole message was essentially, no, this was all about love and freedom. What are you doing, you absolute weirdos? So I think that the biggest lesson that I've taken from their filmography comes from their film Cloud Atlas, which is that, you know, our lives are not our own. And from womb to tomb, we are bound to others. And with each crime and every kindness, we birth our future, you know, and that concept of existing as just one part of the fabric of our communities, of our world, was really impactful for me. And it's something that I'm really, really grateful that I got to experience, and that I got to see, you know, those films, these people that made them, you know, come out and realize that, oh my gosh, they're like me, and give me something to aspire to. And you know, the message that I think radiates from all of their work is that, you know, it's the tattoo that I have, Amor Vincit Omnia, which is Latin for love conquers all. And so that's my big pop culture lesson, is love conquers all. And I genuinely believe that.
That's a good lesson to learn. I think I've watched The Matrix so many times, and the lessons I focus on are, those are really cool fight scenes. So I need to get deeper into it.
Oh, my gosh. Yeah. Well, listen, we could do a whole other podcast where we talk about the fight choreography and, you know, the cinematography. I mean, Bill Pope, who shot the original trilogy. Oh, my God. Also, I might add, native Kentucky and Kentucky proud. We love Bill Pope. you know, we could do all of that. And, you know, two things can be true at once. You know, you can have work, whether that's, you know, from The Matrix to Sense8, that's got incredible fight sequences, but also has a lot to say about the interconnected and interwoven nature of human existence. Two things can be true at once.
Yeah. Are there also any books you look to for leadership inspiration that have guided your leadership development?
Yeah. So one of the books that I cannot recommend enough is Burn the Page by Danica Rome. Danica Rome is the first out and seated trans legislator in the entire country. And she's also the person who gave me you know, in a very roundabout way, the courage to transition to begin with. I had tried to transition, it did not go well, and I detransitioned. And I thought, I'm going to, you know, just have to stay in the closet forever. And I made a little bet with myself when I heard about, okay, there's this 33-year-old vegan yoga loving metal singer in Virginia who's a trans woman running for office. And I was like, okay, sure, if she wins her race, then I'll transition. And against all odds, she did. And I went, oh, gosh, I don't have any excuse now. And so eventually she, you know, wrote a book about that experience and about her life prior to it. And, you know, it's a book that deals a lot with leadership, and it deals a lot with the stories that we tell about ourselves and our willingness to, you know, proverbially, as the title suggests, burn the page and write a new story. I'm very, very lucky that, again, through working with an organization like LGBTQ Victory Fund, that I've gotten to learn from her directly. And, you know, she's somebody that I now can proudly call not just an inspiration, but a mentor and a friend. And that's amazing. But she wrote this book, and I remember reading it during the 2023 legislative session in between committee meetings, my copy that I had checked out from the Tate's Creek Public Library, and really considering what it means to be the only person like you in the room, and the impact that that can have at a moment in my life when I was really struggling with that concept. So I think that the leadership lessons that are in that book aren't just applicable to trans folks. They're applicable to anybody who feels unheard or unrepresented. And so highly recommend it. And I can testify that the Lexington Public Library does stock it. And you can go check out the copy that I checked out a few years ago. And who knows, maybe in a few years, if you're interested in running for office, you can check that out. And then you'll be in elected office one day.
Sounds like it could be a useful guide for people.
Yeah.
Are there any, you mentioned a number of local and global leaders already. Are there any other local or global heroes you look up to?
Yeah, I mean, there's an incredibly long list of people that I look up to. I'm going to list two examples off the top of my head. The first one being Jacqueline Coleman, who's our lieutenant governor. Anybody who knows me knows that I am just the biggest fan of our lieutenant governor. And the reason that I'm going to I could go on and on about different reasons, but she has done so much while in public office that has, I think, shifted the conversation about, you know, women in office. So she gave birth while lieutenant governor, and she also underwent a double mastectomy while in public office as a, you know, measure against what was potentially going to be breast cancer for her. And she was open about those things. That wasn't something that she was hiding from people or doing in secret. She spoke openly about those things and about the struggles that came with them. And it really showed me that there's strength and vulnerability. And I think that she's done a remarkable job of exhibiting that. And so that's certainly something that I aspire towards. And she's somebody that I think is just remarkable. And then the other person that I think of is my hero. Still, it's my grandfather. He is the only other person in my family who ever pursued or won elected office. So he was elected to his school board over in Mercer County back in the day when there was an ongoing, you know, this was in the middle of the civil rights movement. This was in the middle of the national push for integration and desegregation based on race. And, you know, he was a white dude. And at the time, there was not a lot of popular support for integrating the public school system, especially in Kentucky. But he led that charge and he cast the deciding vote to desegregate. And he did so knowing full well that it would cost him his seat in the next election. You know, to the extent that you can know something like that. And growing up, when we were talking about that, he would always talk about, you know, you do what's right, even when it's not what's easy. And he knew that that was the right thing to do. And he did it even though it came at the cost of his own personal ambition. And so I always aspire to do what's right, even and especially when it's not what's easy.
Those amazing figures you look up to. And then my last question, are there any fictional role models you look up to for leadership?
Oh, my gosh. Is it too on the nose for me to say Leslie Knope?
I love Parks and Recreation.
Me too. It's, you know, again, I think a show that's a lot closer to reality than people realize. But the thing that I love about Leslie Knope is that she always shows up with enthusiasm and has big feelings and is unafraid to feel those big feelings. And she also, you know, surrounds herself with people that she can trust and people that, you know, she does what's right even when it's not what's easy. And you see that in that show where, you know, she takes some big political risks in the season where she's running for office. She does it against everybody's advice and still wins. And, you know, that's what it's about. It's about showing up, having passion, and doing the work, leading with love. I think she always did that on that show.
Yeah, she's amazing. I'm really happy to hear that. That's, yeah, one of my favorite TV show characters for sure. Huge fan of Parks and Rec.
Yeah, no, it's great. Always on a loop in my house.
Yep, same. In college, we had it on a loop for so long that, like, in my house, like, we just nicknamed, okay, who was what character? Like, we had someone who was Leslie. Mm-hmm. I was Ben Wyatt. I'm very dorky and analytical, which I love Ben. And then we had someone who was more charismatic, who was Tom. And, yeah, it was...
Oh, my gosh. Yeah, no, it's... my partner, Naomi, is constantly referring to herself as my Ben Wyatt. And it's like, I'll be talking about work and she'll be saying, you know, like, well, as your Ben Wyatt, here's my opinion on that. And it's a wonderful framework.
It's a great inspiration, a great power couple to model yourself
I like to think so. I like to think so. And, you know, we could also do a whole podcast about how remarkable my partner is. But she nonetheless would be, I'm sure, mortified as somebody who does not like to be in the spotlight. So I will cut that conversation there and, you know, deal with whatever fallout comes from me mentioning her on this podcast.
Well, Councilwoman Emma Curtis, thank you so much for taking the time for this interview. It's really been great. Like, I've been hearing about your work for so long, and finally, just such an honor to finally meet you and get to talk with you and learn about your story.
Oh, my gosh. Thank you so much for having me. It's such a joy. And thank you for all you do to highlight the community that we live in and the remarkable leaders who are here.
Oh, thank you so much. That concludes my episode with Emma Curtis, a creative activist, filmmaker, and leader here in Lexington on our city council. As you can tell from the interview, she really loves her city government, and she's so passionate about serving all of her constituents. Also, she reminded me that I definitely need to rewatch the Matrix movies to uncover deeper meanings, and I need to check out the other films she mentioned as well. My next episode will come out in July. Remember to live local and think global, fellow changemakers.